Welcome to Uproar in the Studio, your bi-weekly New York-based Chinese blockbuster podcast. I'm Noah.
I'm Reza.
I'm Andrew.
This week we're talking about The Mermaid, released on February 19th, 2016. It made more than $550 million. You don't have to see it, we'll give a synopsis, but if you want to watch it unspoiled, maybe listen to the show after.
Later, we'll be talking with Bill Borden, a producer of The Mermaid and a longtime collaborator of director Stephen Chow, going back to their work together on Kung Fu Hustle. He also produced the High School Musical series.
But before that, in a first, we're talking about the movie by ourselves. Here's our conversation.
When real estate developer Liu Zhan purchases Green Gulf and begins using violent sonar signals to clear it of wildlife, a hidden society of mermaids becomes trapped in the wreckage of an old ship. The mermaids select Shan to seduce and then assassinate Zhuan, disguising her as a human and sending her to the surface. Zhuan is amazed at Shan's lack of interest in his money and begins to fall in love with her. As she begins to develop feelings for him, Zhuan's development partner, Ru Lan, finds the mermaid hideaway and sends her team of militant scientists to execute the mermaids and retrieve samples. Though the mermaids suffer heavy losses, Zhuan is able to save Shan's life and begins work to restore Green Gulf to the natural beauty it once was. Creepy roadside attractions, poultry-fueled duets, and octopus served fresh. This is Stephen Chow's The Mermaid.
So one thing I was thinking was we could talk about, like, Reza and I have now seen this thing three fucking times.
Yeah, I've seen it once, and I think that that is more than enough.
And I've probably still spent less time watching these than I have spent watching that last god-awful Avengers movie.
Possibly. I watched it two
times. Dude, I watched it definitely the first time with you, and that viewing, I think time was very elusive. The second one, two times speed. The third time, a little more than two times speed.
Yeah, I did 2.1 times speed.
I watched it on a bus on my way to Washington, D.C., crammed between a row of, like, five people. I was in the middle of it, and I got some weird looks while I was watching this movie.
But you've also only watched it with the dub.
I did only watch it with the dub. This is the only movie from this, like, podcast that I watched with the dub. Because I
They're not as good with the dub, but it's...
I didn't know it was an option to watch it with the subtitles. I didn't know that it was in there.
Dude, you goofed.
I told you, you goofed while you were watching it, too.
You did, but I was already so deep in the movie, I was like, I'm not going to switch over it now.
I don't know. The thing is, though, whenever you catch anybody, like, giving you weird looks when you watch a Chinese movie, or especially, I guess, this movie, you just got to be like, dude, like, you've seen Shape of Water, right? This is the prequel.
It's like this plus Amelie is The Shape of Water.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Does this movie imply fish fucking at the end?
What? Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I feel like
it doesn't
quite go as far as Shape of Water, which I guess makes it a good prequel.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it better already.
I thought
that
the
was
fish fucking was
that.
A feature.
Honestly, after I watched Shape of Water, I was like, I enjoyed that way more than I should have. And that's why I never want to watch it again.
What?
Why are we talking about Shape of Water right now?
Because that movie is derivative of this movie.
I mean, it's accurate.
That's why Del Toro wouldn't come on the show.
We did invite him. We did invite him on the show.
It was even internally forwarded. And they figured it out. They didn't want to be exposed like that.
We could send him this episode. Maybe he'll reconsider for the future.
But because we've been trying to record this episode for like a month and a half or something, I've managed to actually get kind of into Stephen Chow. I just, for a while there, like I was just watching a Stephen Chow movie at night. They're the old ones when he was like still, when he still owed the triads money.
Allegedly.
Those were so good.
Dude,
Reza, we watched The God of Cookery.
Oh,
that movie is
that was
so
good.
Amazing.
The only Stephen Chow movie I've seen aside from this one, The Mermaid, is Kung Fu Hustle. I saw that. That got added.
Dude, Shaolin Soccer?
No, I've never seen it.
Oh, you're missing out. Shaolin Soccer.
Actually really good.
Quality. But I think all of his movies from the 90s are actually really good because they're just fucking nuts. They're just absurd and it's beautiful.
I mean, he does this thing where he basically makes cartoons with real people.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
And he does it on this movie too. It's just that the, you know, this movie sucked.
Well, it has a lot more blood in this movie, too. Like, a lot more gore and shit.
Well, so, what I was saying at one point was that it's, like, an extension of slapstick, right?
Mm-hmm.
You move from, like, a slapstick to a gun-heavy massacre, you know?
I mean, I guess.
You try to push it until it's not funny.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you have that scene in the beginning of the movie where you have all of the, like, the mermaid and, like, sea creature hybrids that have all of their, like, ocean-themed weapons, and they're gonna kill a millionaire, and that's the whole thing. But then, like, because it's kind of almost comic at that point, because you see these, like, big weapons, but you think they're not gonna use them, they're not gonna actually do anything to this guy, because then the movie would end. But then you get to the end of the movie, where you just have a whole bunch of people lined up with machine guns to the mermaid pit, and they're just shooting everybody nonstop, and it's just like, holy shit.
The water fills with mermaid blood.
Like, Jesus Christ, what the fuck?
Dude, I mean, that's human nature. That's what the Communist Party is showing us. This is what happens.
Well, that's what you have to do.
When you let a white man into China, this is what happens.
Russian, for actually.
Yeah, no, there is that one white scientist.
Still the white man.
I feel like he was not a driving force of this, honestly.
No, he started
he was a driving force for that part.
He was he's mostly a stuntman.
Is he?
Yeah.
You looked this guy up.
I tried to get this guy up.
Oh, that would have been good. I wanted him on the show pretty bad.
I was going through all sorts of, like, Russian social media and shit, trying to find him.
Does he even have any lines? Or does he just laugh?
No, he has a couple lines. He delivers some lines in Mandarin at one point.
Okay.
But so it's interesting.
White people who just decide to be bad actors in China. They're the best. Their contribution to the arts are unreal.
Razor, we're gonna have to cut that part out. A lot of them come on this podcast.
That's exactly why we're leaving that exchange. A lot of them come on this podcast, but not many of them listen to it.
Oh god.
Next to none listen to it, probably. Maybe
nobody listens to this. But yeah, let's walk this mother from the beginning. Let's walk from the beginning of this movie through. So
I mean, you're gonna do a synopsis at some point.
I'm gonna do a synopsis, but
first scene in this movie, just like the very first scene in every movie we tend to review, it was incredible.
I don't remember what the first scene.
Remember the Museum of World Exotic Animals?
Yeah, the guy being a fake mermaid.
Oh yeah, that was gross.
Yeah.
What he do? He comes around at the end of the movie too for no reason.
He takes that picture that the student brings the guy.
Yeah, he takes the picture after the mermaid gets maimed to shit.
Yeah, she's just missing bits and pieces.
Oh my god, this movie was so fucked.
No, okay, so but like I do think it would be interesting. The evolution of Stephen Chow from these like 90s cartoons essentially to like A, being a mainland, no longer a Cantonese filmmaker, being a mainland Mandarin filmmaker.
Hell yeah.
And
on nationalism.
Exactly. And moving away from, like, being funny, / being in his movies, to, like, making the mermaid. It's an evolution. It shows us where, I guess, China's at today.
I mean, the mermaid does still have, like, comic bits.
I mean, I think it's meant to be funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of just, like, mainland China using his name to distribute a movie, basically. How much do you think he actually contributed to the film?
The producer. He seemed pretty involved.
Mm-hmm.
Later on this episode.
Yeah, later on this episode.
Stick around for us to like...
We need to get Stephen Chow on the show, man. Holy shit. This is what happens when you get that, like, mainland money. We expect too much for $10. Just like at the museum.
No, okay, but, like, there is one funny scene that I found, like, genuinely, like, I was dying laughing, at least the first time I watched it, and it's when he goes in to talk to the cops, and he's like, I was kidnapped by mermaids.
That was awesome. No, that was really funny. Like, just
laugh.
Continuously like, drawing the wrong picture. That was awesome.
Really good. And he's like, why are you laughing? And
my wife just had a son.
The other one laughed.
My wife also had a son. You have the same wife.
Genuinely good comedy.
No, that was like, that's probably the only like 3 minutes that Stephen Chow was on in this film. Let's be honest.
I mean, I think there's like an aspect of it that's like,
yeah,
it speaks to who Stephen Chow is now, right? Mm-hmm. Because he used to make movies about underdogs. He used to make movies about guys who were, like, either fraud gods,
mm-hmm.
or just basically bums. He used to be a Chaplin-esque, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And now he's making a movie about, like, a billionaire.
Yeah, this movie also takes place more...
This is Belt and Road Stephen Chow, man. This is different.
But yeah, the thing with the mermaid, I mean, I really only have Kung Fu Hustle as a point of reference here, but...
He's a bum in that one, though.
Yeah, he is.
He's a wannabe gangster bum.
Yeah.
Wannabe triad.
I wonder who put that in there.
I wonder why he couldn't get a visa to the U.S.
The thing with the mermaid, as opposed to that movie, is just this takes place in a world much closer to our world than Kung Fu Hustle does.
I don't think that's like the God of Cookery very much takes place in like know 90s Hong Kong. It's
I mean the sonar machines weren't in the water yet. You know what I mean? Like there wasn't.
No, they were in there.
Much
that's
of a.
That's why her like brother, maybe whoever she's feeding fish food to, is so damaged.
No, he wasn't old enough in the 90s to be a real person though.
Oh, the sonar wasn't in the water in the 90s, but the sonar is in the water now.
Okay,
exactly. That's why the movie is so different. Yeah.
This is going to be a really confusing exchange.
Well, you'd better build it into the synopsis.
Gonna have to be there somewhere. Oh, we got a siren.
The best character in this movie was definitely the jetpack Chang man.
Actually, he was pretty funny.
And the way they used his jetpack at the end was pretty awesome. Better than Iron Man 3.
Jetpack off his back.
Yeah.
Just blows up.
Yeah.
I think that guy should be Iron Man now that.
Are we putting Endgame spoilers in this podcast?
It's about Endgame.
I haven't seen it, and I know that.
Oh, wow. I mean, I have seen it, and I haven't seen any spoilers saying this online. That is nothing.
I guess
this
because I listen to Chappa.
I think Felix ruined that too.
Yeah. All right, if he did it, then I guess we can here.
Sure.
Who gives a shit? Sorry, audience of seven.
Dude, 140.
I don't know. My mom listens to this podcast, and I don't think that she's seen Endgame yet, so she might be upset.
Sorry, Noah's mom.
I love you. What happened?
We're just apologizing to Noah's mom for the Endgame spoilers.
Dude, she'll still love you, 3000.
Oh,
what a god awful movie.
Andrew doesn't know what I'm talking about.
For a second there, I thought I was hearing like an Andre 3000 reason.
That'd be cooler.
That would be awesome. Outcast should totally be like Avengers.
I think I'd be more down to watch it, and I'd be more down to pay money for it.
Wow. If Avengers was made in the 90s, maybe.
Alright, so...
Do we want to talk about the environment?
Yeah, so we got a Mr. Billionaire in this movie as well. His name is Mr. Liu Xian, and his whole deal is he does not like wildlife.
Well, it's not that he doesn't like
wildlife. He doesn't say that. It's just not his expertise.
No, he just doesn't care. It's money that's the only thing that matters in this world. And then, like, what's her name's like?
Sean?
Her name's Sean.
And then Sean's like, without a breath of fresh air or a drink of clean water, what does money matter?
Yeah.
And then he says that later in the movie. And by that point, I was like, man, I wish he didn't have a breath of fresh air. Shut the fuck up.
Wow.
Also, I was
reading this thing today where, like, funny. I think there was this group of, like, incredible scientists who were like, yeah, like, climate change is real, but we might as well just make our own glaciers, which is awesome and, like, totally awesome. The way that this movie should have gone instead of
plot point from Hello, Mr. Billionaire.
Making glaciers?
Fair enough, that's Sporting right.
Glaciers.
Oh, yeah.
To, like, lower sea level, I guess.
Which I think it's just a desert.
I think the moral of the story is until climate change makes you shit your pants, you don't care about climate change.
I mean,
It's true. Is it really shit his pants? There's also a lot of vomiting in this movie. More vomiting than I noticed watching it 2x speed than I did on the normal speed for some reason.
I guess it brings the vomiting closer together when you have it
it's
going
true.
Faster.
I guess the frequency of people vomiting is, like, more frequent. But, like, when they're on that, like, when they go to eat chicken and then are on, like, carny rides, they vomit. Yeah. It's not even commented on. It's just on there for, like, a few seconds.
No, it just happens.
I mean, one surreal part of the movie was, you know how they, like, lived in that abandoned ship or whatever, but, like, getting into it with that, like, intense bungee or what was it? Like, some weird trampoline mechanism
it,
going on. Awesome.
Yeah.
Just no, to get in and out, it was, like, kind of a weird Rube Goldberg type thing.
I think getting in...
Well, it's not easy to get out of, because you have to go from Guillotine Cliff to this abandoned ship in Green Gulf.
But, yeah. But, yeah, Lujan gets into... So she's into he's into Shan because she doesn't like him. And she's just like, oh, wait, no.
She doesn't want his money.
She doesn't want his money. Because she
wants to kill him.
Yeah.
She doesn't want his money.
She doesn't explain that as the reason she doesn't want his money, but she does explain, like, oh, I don't want your money. I just want to hang out with you.
She does eventually say that I'm supposed to kill you, and they just passionately make out after that.
Yeah.
I think he just ignores it, even though she is holding that, what do you call those?
Urchin?
The urchin knife.
Yeah, the, like, poison.
Oh, no, the urchin pokeball weapon?
Yeah, but the knife that she claims is an opener.
Yeah.
Also, the shit with the, like, her trying to kill him was pretty funny.
Yeah, that was good.
I guess there are funny bits throughout the movie. It's just kind of, either because I've seen it 3 times, or because it's not that great of a movie, it just gets kind of tedious. I don't know why. Because there are good bits peppered throughout.
It's just weird narratively. Like, it's... Like, I don't know. Like, they don't particularly fit well together, I think, like, the different acts in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just about money, and then it's not about money because he shits his pants. That's kind of the synopsis. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What was awesome in this movie? Like, they eat the chicken. He starts crying after eating chicken.
Oh,
so he's kind of just
singing.
Into...
What?
Hmm?
Oh, yeah,
they
singing. Eat
the chicken.
Oh,
they,
yeah,
like,
the singing. I like the singing a lot, actually.
I like that. That was good, sappy.
It was really weird, but I really liked it.
Yeah, well, I think that was... I think this is a Stephen Chow movie that shies away from being weird, which is the problem. But when it gets into those moments that could be in any other Stephen Chow movie, it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah, because this one, it really is... You have fish people, but it's really... It really is rooted in, like... today's concerns and, like, today's world.
But from the perspective...
He sets up a scholarship he's, like, woke for marine biologists.
Also, apparently he's given away all of his money, but he still lives in this, like, seaside mansion.
He gave away a lot of his money at the end of the movie.
No, they
still
say all
by.
Of your money.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he just owned the place.
Maybe.
And he had, like, that bubble thing where he could swim into the, like, water with Sean.
It's possible that he just gave away all of his liquid assets.
Yeah, he still has the sonar, like, dividends from that technology.
Yeah, I mean, he still has, like, ownership over the technology that
he
sold. He
probably
still
owns a lot of buildings.
Yeah,
he's gonna... He tries to trade his car for... Trade, a moped for one of his buildings, and the woman's like, no, I have to make this delivery. So he gets...
I think Jared Kushner should watch this movie. Maybe it'll inspire him.
To fuck a mermaid.
And, like, set up a scholarship for marine biology students in China.
I didn't realize that Jared Kushner had any incentive to care about marine biology.
That's what I'm saying, man. Because he's got the cash. He's an idiot,
sure.
But he's got the cash.
I mean, marine biology is a very important field of study, I suppose.
Jared Kushner is such a good man.
Then people are going to start showing up and asking him, like, are mermaids real? And he's going to be like, no. And people are going to be like, oh, you fucked the mermaid.
I feel like the question that Ivanka would be asking him. No, there are plenty of solid bits in this movie. Just the serious ones are harder to... I feel like the serious ones just aren't so cohesive with the rest of the movie. Because it's like...
Yeah.
A silly idea, like, you have this mermaid who's an assassin. You go in this movie, it's like, assassin mermaid movie, that sounds
pretty
fucking
funny,
that sounds fucking tight. But then you come
in
there
and... She's so weird.
Yeah, but you see these, like, maimed children, and then it's like...
She also wears huff suits.
She also wears what?
You know, like the weed leaf socks? That was
yeah, Huff socks. Like,
oh, does she really?
Yeah.
I mean, like, she just wears patterned socks.
She's gotta be trendy.
Right?
I mean, she's trying to
no,
like,
no, no. At some point, he's like, your fashion is decades out of whack.
Mm. I guess
maybe,
he hasn't heard
maybe
of
the
Huff
Chinese
socks.
Wore Huff socks in the 90s.
What is he saying? He wears a suit in every fucking scene.
Yeah, but
dude,
sometimes
that's what businessmen do.
Yeah. Right.
How do you make deals if you're not wearing a suit?
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like it doesn't show a whole lot of fashion prowess on his part that he just wears the same outfit.
Nah, that's just class. You wouldn't get it.
I mean, I guess not.
I mean, at some point, there's like, I think at some point his, like, ability to change clothes sort of breaks down. I feel like he's just caught up in this thing.
They had to fire the costumes.
Well, I actually don't know if it even takes place over that many days. Also, the one, the sort of, his uncle there?
Yeah.
The sort of, I guess you haven't seen it in a while, but
No, I know what you're talking about. His uncle, who's like the initial investor, who's just like, hey,
trying to bid for it.
Yeah, but he's also saying like, hey, maybe this was a terrible investment. Hey, maybe you are a complete fuck-up as a businessman, and this was a bad idea.
Exactly. That guy's actually like a pretty well-known director who did,
Really?
Yeah, he did the Taking of Tiger Mountain.
He's the John Huston of this movie.
Right, yeah, he's the John Huston of this Chinatown. Yeah. This quality production starring the Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we can run through his other investors, too, because they were pretty weird as well.
Well, so we talked about
it was that. Just Chang.
Well, yeah, but there was also his girlfriend, his, like, ex-girlfriend. Their relationship was weird.
It was.
She was just a real estate magnate. Like an old money real estate magnate, right?
She's old money and he's new money, and that, like, she keeps making fun of him for, like, you'll always be a peasant.
Yeah.
You'll always have your peasant taste fucking mermaids.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that.
You're trying
dynamic.
To fuck mermaids.
I forgot
everywhere.
The new versus old money, like, class
dynamic. It's in all these movies.
I mean, yeah.
We just end up talking about this every fucking week.
Because that's, like, that's just so. That's what China is now.
It's usually not so explicit, though, because you don't have characters coming up to other characters and saying, you're below me because your money is new. Like, you don't.
Your money is not real good.
Yeah. But, like, that's a thing that happens almost literally in this movie.
No, it 100% happens literally.
I really like his brand of new money, though. He just kind of does as he pleases, leaves when he wants. Like,
yeah, I guess he has the big house. He doesn't have a jetpack. He's not so rich that he can get
a
jetpack.
He seizes a jetpack.
Yeah.
He does seize a jetpack. But he also, like, I think him not having a jetpack is to just sort of say, oh, this guy kind of has taste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? I mean,
unlike the other guy who actually dresses like, like Hello, Mr. Billionaire.
He does.
And, like, Yuffie.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit is with the bit. Like out there.
He does not. He does not have the fashion. Like, the thing is,
Yuffie is coordinating well.
He has the same taste as Yuffie, but he doesn't have the same talent for fashion.
Right.
As Yuffie.
Yeah.
Yuffie knew how to coordinate and he knew how to make it work. This guy just liked colors.
Yeah. Well, kind of like Mr. Billionaire.
Yeah.
You want to defend Yuffie. Ryan Chang, please come on the show.
I mean, the thing is, every episode since then, I've been coming here dressed like Yuffie. You can't see it because it's a podcast, but I'm in head to toe color.
You might not know this, but Noah has started dressing like Yuffie.
Yeah.
Wait, that's kind of awesome.
You should see these,
What
do you call them?
I don't know, double-breasted vests?
I was thinking like
the thing they wore in the movie.
No, he has suspenders. Suspenders.
Oh, yeah. Everywhere
beautiful
I go.
Suspenders.
Everywhere I go.
Tiger
do they have patterns?
Oh, so many patterns. Sometimes one pattern on one and a different pattern on the other. I'm killing the game here.
You need to add to your repertoire with, like, Huff
shirt. Yeah. No.
Like, what he's actually wearing is a DK shirt.
Now we need our Huff socks and the skateboard. It was really weird, though. You know how, like, the white man SWAT team goes after, like, the mermaids?
Were they mostly white, though? I think it was just the one white scientist.
No, it was just the Russian guy who was white.
No, I said the white man SWAT team.
Oh, the white man's
possessive.
Yes, I see.
But was it even his SWAT team?
No, I think it belonged to the
collective.
No, to the semi kind
of
girlfriend.
The real estate, the real estate.
Let me riff on our Cold War like enemies. Let's let this be. But like at one point they're like on that speedboat and they're just eating watermelon. And I noticed that only on my third viewing, but that
I didn't notice.
What was that about? Dude, they just cut into a watermelon and start going at it for like 3 seconds. Like that's the only, like that's the focal part of that scene.
It's a good summer fruit. Why can you say?
Yeah, Russians do sometimes do that.
Yeah. Speaking from experience as a Russian. Yeah.
Chopping watermelons with machetes all the time.
Yeah.
Fun summer memories.
Yeah, maiming rare marine life.
Yeah, dude, it's how you do. Yeah. How do you think you get caviar?
What was actually, because it was revealed in the end of it that, like, the real estate person, her entire goal this entire time was because she knew that the mermaids were hidden out there and that she was going to go after them for some reason with this weird, crazy scientist who's, like, labeled as a crazy scientist in a really weird way.
She explicitly calls him a nut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
like
he
you.
Laughs.
She says to, this Mr. Billionaire, like you.
Yeah, and then
he's
laughs
a nut,
maniacally.
Just like you. Yeah, he rips off his tie.
Yeah,
rips open his shirt, and
yeah.
He's like, ah.
Now it's like at that point, then you understood why they got such a jacked guy to play that scientist because they knew that they needed to use it.
Well, there's a point where
yeah.
I mean, this is a very small thing.
Okay,
but I was thinking about him being a stuntman because he jumps from one big boat to the little boat. Very, very agile.
Yeah, no,
good jumping.
So.
Good
yeah.
jumping. Solid jumping.
Top notch.
I wish the like the lead mermaid had a bigger role in this movie. You know, like the Thanos mermaid.
Oh,
the grandma
one?
Mermaid.
The one with the big fin.
Yeah.
Like
mythology mermaid.
He had mad powers, but decided to show up to the battle like at the very end, which is
And then she just gets blasted out of there by the Russian dude.
Yeah, it would have been different if she was, like, their last line of defense or something like that, but no, she was just chilling.
How did they make her entrance so dramatic after they had already massacred most of the population?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was like, wouldn't she have done something before then?
Maybe she was napping.
Yeah.
She did have that, like, one, like, strong attack. It was very, very effective.
Yeah.
I appreciated how different the designs for the mermaids were. Like during this,
I mean, I think they just kind of look like they look like the people in the yard in Kung Fu Hustle, like
except for the Octopus Man.
Yeah, with the dreads.
Yeah, I forgot about his dreads. Holy shit! Yeah,
to match his tentacles.
Yeah,
I kind of really like the bits with him too. There's a lot of good bits in this movie.
He
just
had a lot
weirdly
of
strung together. Yeah, I mean, it was weird slapstick in that he kept getting cooked.
Yeah. Every time he came on screen, I was wondering, like, are they going to go there?
And they did.
And they did. They,
every
like,
time.
Cut off
really
all
good.
Of this man's tentacles.
Well, no, he ends up with some tentacles.
He ends up
and
with
he
two.
Also seems
he ends
to
up
have grown them
two.
Back in the final shot of the film.
Maybe?
He's, like, propelling away from the camera.
Yeah.
I did also enjoy that part where she was, like, making planes with water and shit.
Yeah.
That was badass.
Well,
she dropped, like, Hiroshima. She dropped the Hiroshima nuke.
Yeah, she did. Oh my god.
Yeah, it was kind of cool.
Out entirely out of water.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Shan wasn't magic at all. That was a different thing. Because, like, obviously the
her laugh was pretty magical.
Oh. She also could sing really well. But yeah, that didn't.
Cool.
Yeah, these are superpowers, though. Like what?
Like the leader of Turkmenistan has.
Yes.
Now, here's our interview with Bill Borden, producer on The Mermaid and Kung Fu Hustle.
Could you just tell us how you initially met Stephen Chow?
I was working with Jackie Chan in Hong Kong, and I was making a movie for Columbia Pictures, and I received a call from the chairman, or the vice chairman of Columbia Pictures, a guy named Gareth Wiggin, who said, there's a filmmaker in Hong Kong that we'd like you to meet. And I met him. And at the meeting, Stephen gave me a 17-page, well, maybe it was 11-page treatment for Kung Fu. It was called Kung Fu at that time. I read it. I thought it was brilliant. And we talked to the studio, and they paid him to write the screenplay, which he did in about 10 weeks.
Oh.
And maybe it was a little longer. But at that time, I was working over there in Hong Kong, so that's how it happened.
I think the Jackie Chan movie is The Medallion, is that right?
Yeah, The Medallion.
Was that your first experience in Hong Kong cinema?
Yeah, The Medallion was my first experience in Hong Kong. I'd never actually been to Hong Kong before, but I had a deal at Columbia Pictures where I had a housekeeping deal, and they called and introduced me to Jackie.
What was your first impression of Mr. Chow?
Steven is a extremely smart, mercurial guy. He's extremely smart, very thoughtful. You know, sometimes comedians are always funny. You know, if you hang out with Bill Murray, he's funny all the time. Or sometimes comedians aren't that funny. Steven's not funny. His English is not great. You know, his English is definitely not his first language. Mm-hmm. He speaks Cantonese and Mandarin. But he's a very quirky, smart guy. So he has very kind of subtle humor when you hang around him.
Mm.
And he has really wonderful kind of subtle observations. And I think his subtle observations actually feed into his movies. I think his movies are observations of the world that he grew up in, the world that he sees, you know, in China. He kind of moves his life like that, not as an observer, but he comments and observes and comments. It's kind of interesting. I like being around him. And he is a kung fu man. I'm not sure if you call him the master or not, but he is the real deal.
Yeah. Was he at that point trying, because I know he'd had a deal with Miramax to distribute some of his earlier films, was becoming more of an international star like a stated goal at that point for him?
Yeah, I met him right after Shaolin Soccer, and I don't think his experience with Miramax was a great one.
Mm-hmm.
So he was looking around for someone else to be a partner for him, so he picked Columbia, and this is my sense of Steven, is that he wanted to kind of delve into the international world, and Kung Fu Hustle was the really kind of the film that did that for him, because it really did extremely well outside of mainland China and Hong Kong. It was a very large hit. And he made, what I would say, a couple other attempts to do some things that were what I'd call more international. And then he was involved originally in, I forget, was it Green Hornet?
I've heard of, yeah, I heard he was at one point.
Yeah, he was gonna direct and star in Green Hornet with Seth Rogen. And I was tangentially involved at that time because when he was in town, he would take me along and ask advice and meetings. And actually, that's when that fell apart, is when we discussed The Mermaid. But I think that Steven is now, if he was looking kind of west, you could say, at one time, I think he's over that. I don't think he cares about looking west. I think he only cares about doing the work that he loves.
Mm.
And if it's received internationally, it's fine. If it's not, he's absolutely fine with that. Mm. So I don't just think he feels he needs the international recognition. He's just kind of a pure artist in some sense.
Yeah.
He really does what he wants to do. And if it's accepted, that's great. If it's not accepted, that's great.
Just to compare with American international marketing, nowadays I know that a lot of movies, when they're geared towards international audiences, a lot of that international audience is expected to be in China. So I'm just wondering, when you have a Chinese film that is intended for international reception, is it the same kind of mirrored where they intend for it to be successful in America and with American audiences, or is it more widespread global marketing intention?
The Chinese, when I was been involved there for, you know, 14 years, whatever, the Chinese were really concerned at a certain point that their movies be internationally accepted. And they were looking for that Kung Fu Hustle, the Crouching Tiger. They all wanted to be that, and to be nominated for Academy Awards and to be recognized internationally. What had happened over the 12, 14 years is their market share has grown and grown and grown and grown, and they realized on the financial side, to be successful, they don't have to be internationally successful. They can just be domestically successful. And I think that even like Steven Mermaid, I don't think there was ever a thought of that being internationally successful. I always thought, like, Steven would only cared about the Chinese market. he felt he was sticking to his roots. He's Chinese. He's going to make it. If it was accepted internationally, he was happy. If it wasn't accepted, he was happy. I don't think he cared a bit. And I think, generally speaking, that attitude is the attitude that a lot of Chinese filmmakers have embraced lately, because the market there is so big, and they've learned that it's dealing with international distribution is a pain in the neck. It's really difficult, and you don't get paid, and you spend money doing things, and you do all this stuff, and it doesn't, you know, it adds a lot of cost to your picture and everything, and it doesn't really help you in China that much. So a lot of the new filmmakers seem to be, you know, Feng Gao, Xiaogang, and people, it's like, I don't care about the international market anymore. I just care about making great Chinese movies. And look at the size of the market.
Yeah.
It's like enormous.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the United States, for us to just, you know, to distribute a picture around the world, I might be set a little high, but, it, you know, it's $75 million to get it distributed around the world, $100 million. To distribute a movie in China, like The Mermaid or Monster Hunt, Bill Kong's a friend, he said, what's your marketing budget? Oh, $5 million. Oh, we chased the movie and we spent $10 million on P&A. You can't open a movie in the United States for less than $35
million. Yeah.
So all of a sudden they look around and they go, oh, if we make a movie for the international, we don't make any extra money. Why bother doing it? Let's just make the best Chinese picture that we can make. I think Steven is definitely a great artist and has that attitude.
It seems interesting to me that it is like a more of a whole China thing now, because he is very much an icon of, or he was certainly very much an icon of Hong Kong. Do you think with something like with The Mermaid, which is in Mandarin, unlike some of his earlier films, it is more of a focus on the mainland?
Being a Hong Kong filmmaker, first of all, there's very few of them left. They've all basically moved to Shanghai and Beijing, because that's where the market went, and that's where the money went. But Steven was not a filmmaker that had to put up with censorship at all, because he was a Hong Kong filmmaker. So and I think you see shades of that in Kung Fu Hustle, that has violence and it has guns and it has criminals. You don't see that out of Chinese filmmakers at all, just, you know, mainland China, because it's a very touchy, anything to do with machine guns or violence. I know this is pre-Mao, which means you have a lot more leeway, but I think so the influence of, for me, I look at Steven as that filmmaker that has one foot in Hong Kong still and doesn't have the governors built on him that some of the Chinese filmmakers have. He's willing to explore subjects that are a little bit more on the cusp of could be controversial, like Kung Fu Hustle. It was about gangs. It was about gangland activity in Guangzhou. It was mainland China, so...
Yeah, it seems like The Mermaid is also jumping into sort of touchy territory with the environmental themes. Was that something he was thinking a lot about before that?
Yeah, that was one of the initial ideas. Is you do the initial pitch that I gave to Steven about The Mermaid was, you know, there's a one last group of a colony of mermen that is left in some southern China. You know, Hanyan Island, or some place that was still pure, and that Chinese expansion and Chinese commercialism was going to wreck that. So, which is a fairly controversial Chinese idea, but I think that the Chinese have recently more embraced green technology and you know, listen, they're suffering with their air and they're suffering with the quality of their food, so. It was a subject matter that I thought was timely in China, and so did Steven. That was the original thing. It was like, oh, I'm here in this country watching from very kind of pure, you go out and, not in Shanghai. When I first was in Shanghai, it was still, you know, Hutong buildings, and now they're all gone. I mean, if you want to watch the kind of change over the years, and Steven and I would scout. We were in like southern China and more western China, and we were wandering around for another movie that we were planning, and you saw the purity of China, right? Away from the big cities, just absolutely pristine China still. No smog, any old water buffaloes. You see this pristine China, and you realize that then you go into the kind of more polluted Beijing and Guangzhou and Shenzhen and Guangdong. You know, it's like, oh my God, you know, there's pollution here.
Yeah.
And I think that China has woken up. And the mermaid, that was part of the concept behind the mermaid.
Yeah, the violence in the mermaid as compared to the violence in Kung Fu Hustle is, I think, presented much more somberly, especially with the massacre towards the end.
Yeah.
Was that ever a worry about how that would be seen by audiences or by censors?
The audiences are used to American violence and American. It's always a censorship issue if China wants to present violence in their mainland or how it's presented. You know, you get this even type stuff. You turn in your scripts, you get them approved. If they're not approved, they tell you why they're not approved. You can do rewrites. But I don't think violence has anything to do with audience. It's just strictly governmental censorship approval. And Mermaid is obviously a fantasy, right?
Yeah.
So you have a lot more leeway. Enormous amount more leeway when you deal with fantasy.
Do you think Steven's previous reputation also gives you some extra leeway?
Absolutely. It helps enormously. Listen, we did Mission Impossible 3 in China, and a lot of movies would never be able to do what we did there because of the prestige of the project. And it goes with Steven. Steven has an enormous amount of prestige and weight in China. And he's proven to be a very positive force in the movie industry, and he's not a political person, Steven. You know, he's a comedian in some sense. And the Mermaid, it wasn't really that political, even if people might consider the Green Movement political. It was really this fantasy about falling in love. I mean, kind of.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that Steven's not really very political as a person, but he's a comedian, and do you think that him being a comedian and his comedy in his movies allows him to get away with more societal critique than would otherwise be permissible to a filmmaker in China?
In terms of censorship, I wasn't as involved in the censorship part of, or the submission of the Mermaid to Scarf, but so I can't comment if they had comments on that, but they did have some comments on Kung Fu Hustle. They were adjusted. Some things were adjusted, and we moved forward. It's a very difficult subject.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's gray. It's not black and white. There isn't a book you look it up and say, oh, we're not allowed to do this. It's just, that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And if the movie seems to have good intentions and has some violence, maybe you can get away with it. If the censorship board feels that there's violence and it doesn't mean anything, then all of a sudden you reject it.
Could you describe just sort of how he develops the set pieces and the bits in the various films? Does he have collaborators on that sort of thing, or is it largely coming from him?
Steven has kind of a war room where you walk in and there's a whiteboard, multiple whiteboards. He has a couple collaborators that their names are on, you know, on the movies. He works with other writers, and they sit in a room, and it's a bit different than some one person sitting down and writing a feature. That's not how it's done. Steven writes, they sit around for days, weeks, months in the room, and you walk in there, and there's all kinds of ideas on the boards. And Steven writes, and someone might write a scene, and in the end, it's always given to Steven to finish. But there's definite input, and Steven is very collaborative. He'll do collaboration, but he is the final word, without a doubt. But there is a writer's room of two or three people. At least that's my experience in the times I've worked with Steven.
I know the decision for him to mostly stop appearing in his films himself came before The Mermaid and previous films, but do you know anything about what influenced that?
I think that this is just my opinion, because we were talking about doing Kung Fu Hustle 2, and Steven one time said to me, I think that this would be the last movie that I start in. And I think it has to do with just age. It's just like, I don't need to be a star anymore. I just want to be a filmmaker.
Yeah.
I've been the star. I've been in front. I don't need it. And when he was doing Green Lantern, I know he, the first thing that this, as it started going south a bit, he was, you know, the sidekick to Seth Rogen, right? I'm just blanking out. Green
Hornet, yeah.
Green Hornet. What's the name of the sidekick that was...
Former Bruce Lee role.
The former Bruce Lee role. So, because, you know, Bruce Lee is Steven's hero.
Yeah.
But, and then Steven said to me, we were sitting, you know, Cafe Parish and Cafe Roma in downtown Beverly Hills, and he said, I don't think I want to be compared to that to Bruce anymore. I think that I should just be behind the camera.
Mm.
So I think it has to do with age. Just like, I don't need that anymore.
Yeah.
I'm happy behind the camera.
Why do you think The Mermaid was the one of all of his later career films that sort of was the biggest hit?
I wish I knew.
Yeah.
I don't. Yeah, it's like, it hit the zeitgeist. It was just the right time.
Yeah.
It was a Chinese film made for the Chinese audience. The market had just been, you know, there's an A market, a B market, a C market, the D market had opened up. Movie theaters were exploding in China. It was a Chinese subject matter. Everyone's aware of the green movement and smog and polluted food and ruining this pristine China environment. I think it touched that zeitgeist of the country.
Mm.
And it took off.
On that point of something that might have touched the zeitgeist, I find it interesting that in a lot of his earlier films, he plays the underdog, someone who's struggling financially, but at the center of this one is, I would say, at least a billionaire, right? Do you know what the thinking behind that was?
Well, Steven is the underdog, right? That's his whole thing. I don't know. My original pitch... And the mermaid was, there was a very rich guy, and in a colony of mermen and merwomen realized that the rich guy was going to be the bad guy, and that they were going to go take him down, and he has an epiphany in the end. So that was the pitch. Is it an evolution in Steven's characters? Probably, but that was the pitch.
Do you think there's anything
Steven
about...
said, oh, it's genius. I remember it. And he said, oh, that's a genius idea. Let's do it. So... he liked the pitch.
Yeah. But do you think there's anything about that sort of character that might have struck a chord with audiences in a country with greater and greater wealth disparity? Or about that sort of story of, you know, a billionaire coming to his senses?
I mean, that's what I think it touched the zeitgeist, is that the billionaires want to be one of us. Right now, even in China, you can become a billionaire. I mean, you know, the guys that are running, you know, Ma and stuff, you know, he's the richest man in China. He wasn't rich.
Yeah.
Any money. So I think that the underpinnings of all those characters are peasants, right? That's where they all come from, in the Chinese sense of the word peasant, right? Of land, you know, people that just work the land, and it's kind of their tradition.
What do you see your future as in terms of Chinese film? Do you plan to be in the Asian market more so in the future?
Well, you know, I created High School Musical.
Mm-hmm.
For Disney.
Yeah.
And I'm doing that series right now. I'm doing it for the new streaming channel. So right now, for the next couple of years anyway, I'm focused on doing that series and get it relaunched. So that's what I'm focused on. I have a couple of Chinese projects left over, but my main attention right now is to get into, just make sure this is a great series.
Yeah.
That's my main attention.
Noah was actually mentioning to me just before we got on the line that you'd franchised High School Musical all around the world and had made versions of it around the world.
Yeah, we did one in China, Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, and yeah, we didn't franchise them. They were actually productions.
Oh, okay.
We and they were actually, we didn't franchise it at all. It was literally a production. In Argentina, you make a production.
Is there anything about that property that you think makes it so successful internationally?
Well, High School Musical was, you know, the American version was tremendously successful internationally. And we just had all these requests to do it in their own language. So that's why we did it in different languages. Listen, it was an international franchise. I think Bob Iger once said that the franchise made $1.6 billion.
Wow.
That's not bad for a little movie.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, so that is going to be the end of this episode of Opera in the Studio. Thank you again to Bill Borden.
Our original music comes from Elliot Saltmarsh and Yehuda of Fist with a PH, and our art comes courtesy of Jay Castro.
Follow us on Twitter at China Film Pod, like the Uproar in the Studio Facebook page, and maybe even Venmo us at Reza-Said and put Uproar in your description. All proceeds will go towards the Green Gulf Cleanup Project. Every penny counts in our efforts in saving the mermaids. And if you feel like it, have some thoughts or suggestions, email us at uproarinthestudio, all in one word, at gmail.com.
Remember to rate and share our podcast to help us bop, 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 bop to the top of the iTunes podcast recommendation algorithm.
We're all in this together.
In 2 weeks, we'll be talking about Detective Chinatown 2. But before we leave you this week, we just want to share some wisdom from the chairman.
To read too many books is harmful. We'll see you in 2 weeks.